Hi everyone, welcome to the latest episode of the EFL Magazine Business Podcast. This is Season 3, Episode 25 of the podcast. Today's guest is Jarrod Merlot. Jarrod is the Principal Consultant of NounsandVerbs.com, where he helps schools, publishers and companies digitize their language learning and testing products, content, assessment, media, marketing, teaching and strategy. He co-founded and spent the last 10 years building an edtech company called E2 that specializes in B2C and B2B high-stakes English exam prep that has registered over 1.5 million users. He's also the face of E2's YouTube channels that have over 2.5 million subscribers. I really enjoyed today's podcast with Jarrod, and please have a look at the show notes at the bottom for the upcoming EFL Magazine Entrepreneur Conference. And if you book before the 10th of August, you get a $10 discount. So go and sign up straight away. I hope you enjoy the podcast.
Hey everyone, buckle up for a new episode of the EFL Magazine Business Podcast, the one and only podcast made to help you launch your business or take your existing business to a level of success you could never have imagined. Whether you're a school owner, freelancer, publisher, or other entrepreneur, you're sure to pick up lots of actionable advice when you listen to the EFL Magazine Business Podcast. Remember to visit EFLmagazine.com for great articles and features. Without further ado, here's your host, the founder of EFL Magazine, Philip Pound.
Great. Good morning. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the latest episode of the EFL Magazine Business Podcast. And I'm delighted today to have Jarrod Merlot from, he's co-founder of E2 and is now in private consultancy and pursuing a PhD. So a busy guy. Good morning, Jarrod.
Morning, Phil. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much. And I really like your apartment. Nice light coming in the window. Long mirror. I can see your neck as well as your face. But So tell me where you are today.
I'm in Melbourne in Australia.
Fantastic. And are you based in Melbourne? Are you from Melbourne originally?
Yeah, kind of. This is pretty much my home city. I being an English teacher, of course, I did the whole stint in a few different countries. I think I taught English in Indonesia, South Korea for a couple of years. I studied in India, spent some time in an Aboriginal community in the north of Australia. Where else have I been? I'm probably forgetting somewhere, but so I've done the traveling around thing in my 20s, and then came back here when I was about 25, and that's when I started E2 actually with a couple of other co-founders.
So tell me a little bit about your studies and travels and work in Indonesia, India.
Yeah. Look, man, that was just pivotal. It was such a I came from a pretty small country town. I grew up in a small country town, so I was desperate to sort of get out and see the world. So I started off in Yogyakarta in Java in Indonesia, studying Bahasa Indonesia, the language, and also had the opportunity at the ripe old age of 20 to teach English at a university without having any idea of what I was doing there. Like, I was just complete beginner. But that was a great experience. So I stayed there for a year. After that, I went to India and studied philosophy. I was very interested in Eastern philosophy. I still am. It's just a sort of personal passion of mine to read into Buddhism and Hinduism and stuff like that. I find that stuff really fascinating, the contemplative traditions. So I had the opportunity to study at University of Mysore for a semester, philosophy, social sciences, the language, Sanskrit, and the local language, Kannada, of which I remember zero. That was a extraordinary experience. And then following that, I went and lived in South Korea for a couple of years and taught English and avoided drinking too much booze, which seems to be what the main hobby of English teachers in South Korea. But I had the opportunity there to teach at a pretty exclusive private, one of those foreign language high schools. I think it was the second best high school in the country in terms of in terms of grades, I don't know if I'd call it the best school, but in terms of their study habits, but they studied a lot. That was interesting. And then I had a really unique experience living in a very small Aboriginal town in it's called Northeast Arnhem Land or Yirrkala, where they speak their first language is Yuwamata, and they speak several other dialects. And I think English is like their fourth or fifth language. So I spent a year there doing some social work, mucking around, played a little bit with the language there. Of course, it's a pre-literate society, so they don't really have a written language. They do now, of course. Some very interesting stuff going on there. And then I came back to Melbourne and taught English in an English school here, did a master's degree in applied linguistics, focusing on technology and language learning. That seemed the sort of right thing to do at the time. It probably still does, I think, you know, obviously, especially post-COVID, everything's technological. And now, I mean, we can talk about E2. That was I did that for 10 years, that company. But now I've just left E2 about 3 months ago. I'm doing a bit of private consultancy before I start a PhD in applied linguistics and language assessment in particular.
There's a lot to pick apart there. And you talked about beer drinking in Korea, but I've tasted Korean beer. So, you know, it's easy enough to avoid. Sorry.
Yeah, for well, there's only Koreans two. Talking. There's only two. That's right. They're ripe for a craft beer revolution like we've had in Australia.
Yeah, exactly. And you've got the what in Australia, the 4X and the 2Hees, isn't it? And
if you go to the supermarket in Australia now, there's probably about 40 or 50 different beers you can choose from. Like we've had the craft beer revolution. In fact, I think everybody's now turning back to the 2Hees and the 4X because they're sick of pineapple flavored beer and, you know.
Yeah, exactly. And the price as well. It's a little bit pricier than a craft beer, although it is delicious.
It's actually cool now to drink the beer that our fathers and grandfathers drank, not the craft beer.
It's like the what they call builder's tea, isn't it? Where they had all these hipster places, you know, you could get your oolong and your pu'er tea, and then they have like builder's tea, which is just your regular bog standard tea that we all grew up with. Yeah, that's what they go back to. And interested to hear about going to Mysore in India. And of course, the big news over the past few weeks has been Nalanda is going to be re-established. They're building Nalanda again. I don't know if you've heard that story.
No.
Yeah, I think I'm not quite sure of the plans, but over the next few years, you're going to rebuild Nalanda University. So keep an eye out for that one. So tell me about coming back. You spent how many years abroad?
I think I was away for about 6-7 years, something like that. Yeah.
And how about the reverse culture shock coming back? Was it okay coming back to Australia? You were able to settle in pretty easily?
Yeah, look, it definitely took some time. 25, especially Korea was the country just before I came back to Australia. And it took a while. It took a while, definitely. Luckily, Melbourne is such a great city and I grew up, you know, 3 hours south of here. So it did feel like home. I was straight into a share house when I moved back into Melbourne. So that sort of, that gets you into the swing of things living with, the Melbourne hipsters up in North Fitzroy. So, yeah, I fitted back in pretty well.
Yeah, and a lot of people who come, I think I was in Melbourne maybe about 10 years ago, 12 years ago, and a lot of Australians even that come to Melbourne this time of year, they're surprised actually how wet and cold Melbourne can be in the winter.
Man, you should see it today. It's just a puddle out there.
Yeah. We think for Australia, obviously it's sunny Australia, but, I was surprised. It was almost like being back home in Ireland when I landed in Melbourne. I wasn't expecting that, but, so you came back and E2, how did that come about? You were twiddling your thumbs and you said, okay, let's start something, or what was the genesis of E2?
Yeah, I picked up a bit of an entrepreneurial spirit from my brother. And then when I came back to Melbourne, I was teaching English in the classroom and it didn't seem like a great trajectory for me. I was hungry to do something else, not other than English language teaching, but sort of scale my work a little bit more. Because one of the things I notice, of course, is you teach a great lesson and then it evaporates into thin air. So, of course, the first natural thing to think was, okay, what about if I recorded these on video and posted them on the internet? So with one of the co-founders, we wrote a grammar syllabus and recorded, this is our minimum viable product, which is a bit stupid, 308, I think, short grammar videos, built a website, posted these grammar videos of which I was teaching and a few others were teaching. And, of course, didn't make a cent, because who the hell is going to pay for a grammar course? We could give it away for free, but only to really to rocket scientists and brain surgeons. You know, somehow they found it and cottoned onto it after we paid for some Google AdWords. But there was no money to be made in this video grammar course. So what happened next was a stroke of fortune. We weren't even really thinking about test prep, but an opportunity came along. I'll backtrack a little bit. Luckily enough, in Melbourne, Australia, there is the OET English language test, which is the test for medical professionals. It covers 12 medical professionals. It's actually a subsidiary of Cambridge University, so it's related to the IELTS and whatnot. Co-owned by Cambridge University. Anyway, fortunately enough, their head office is in Melbourne, so we sort of had this opportune meeting with the CEO, and she said, hey, why don't you do some OET test prep? So we sort of built a bit of a prototype OET course for nurses, and I jumped on Skype at the time, I think it was. This is 12 years ago. No, it would have been about 8 years ago, something like that. You know, and started sort of teaching, giving tutorials and, you know, people going through our online resources which we'd sort of, you know, bashed out. They weren't very good at all, but there was a market and a pretty hungry market as well. And all of a sudden we saw, you know, we plugged in the e-commerce and holy crap, people started paying for this test prep course. And so that was, you know, we pivoted immediately. We shifted away from teaching core English language stuff to OET specifically, hired a couple more teachers to do the tutorials. At this point, I started doing webinars, you know, and it started off with 2, 4, 6, 8, you know, exponential growth. All of a sudden, I had about 300, 400 OET candidates in these webinars. We started posting these webinars onto YouTube. We started getting traffic from YouTube coming across to the website. It created this nice cycle. So we had one test down. And then at about that time, PTE Academic, which is owned by Pearson Publishers, was new on the market. It had a bit of a following, a candidature in India. Very little social media around it. Like if you went to YouTube and searched PT Academic essay, whatever, you know, there might could be 2 or 3 pretty crappy videos. So we turned our attention to PT Academic and did the same thing, replicated it basically, built the courseware, ran the tutorials, you know, taught the webinars, post them on social media, etc. If you've got any questions, just stop me because I can ramble on.
No, not at all. I'm fascinated. I just had an observation to make, and I'm sure this is something that you've by your tone of voice is that you're imparting to me is that first you put in all this grunt work, all these videos. I don't know how many hours you poured into it.
Hundreds. Yeah,
hundreds of hours, and there was absolutely no market for it. No. Okay, and then secondly, you had the market, and you just needed to build a product.
Yeah, in a sense. I mean, I think what happened was we built that really nascent OET course, and the OET put out an email to their candidates because they were hungry for test prep material because they had the test and they wanted to build an ecosystem of, a cottage industry of test prep providers. And so they were eager for us to provide this. So they actually sent out an email to some candidates. I believe they sent it to a list of 1,000 candidates who had their exam coming up next month or something. And we and we saw all these people signing up for free. We had a freemium offering on this website that we built, you know, a free offering. Holy shit, if I may swear, we were like, whoa, people are actually signing up for free. And then all of a sudden, it was like we got the first sale. I remember it was a Russian doctor based in the UK or something like that. And it was like this guy had just paid $230 or whatever it was. And we were just like, whoa, okay, this is cool. And then the next day there were 5 sales. And then the next day there were 7. And the next day there were 6. And then the next day there were 12. And, you know, it went on like that. So after we sort of discovered that, it was very much, it was just all hands on deck, test prep. We were building the airplane as it flew. You know, we didn't use an off the shelf website like a WordPress or a Squarespace or you know, a Learn Dash or a Canvas or a Moodle. No learning management. We decided to build our own right from the outset because we figured that we wanted it to do things that conventional learning management systems couldn't do. I mean, it was for language learning. Learning management systems are built for, you know, there's an assumption there that the user speaks the language. So we wanted it, and plus we needed to replicate, you know, exam questions. We needed to build in our own scheduling system because we wanted it to perform differently from plugins like Calendly or whatever they are now. Yeah, so we're sort of building this website as we're going. We had a CTO and a couple of programmers over in Indonesia. So what was sort of happening was I was over on the content side, you know, and media side, writing content, building out the media. My other business partner was over on the tech side, designing the platform, you know, building out all the tech. And it was an absolute friggin' nightmare. For a good couple of years, it was a nightmare because, as I said, we were building it as we were going and stuff wouldn't work. We didn't have this. Students were complaining about this. So we're just desperately putting out sort of spot fires and, you know, but it was such a brilliant way to program because it was very much based off what the customer wanted. It was, you know, not only just what the customer wanted in terms of content, they wanted mock tests, they wanted more questions, whatever. So bang, we'd just start doing that. But also what the customer didn't know they wanted, which was something like they wanted to be able to cancel tutorials and reschedule them, or they wanted to be able to switch teachers because they didn't like the first teacher they had with the tutorial. So we're being very adaptive with our software development as well, based off you know, customer feedback, emails coming in from customer support, and just observing what was going on. So it was a chaotic affair, to say the least. But I think what we sort of built out of it, because we ended up doing PT, we ended up doing, then we did IELTS, which was the big one. Then we did TOEFL. Then we did TOEIC, and more recently E2's done CELPIP. So yeah, we just focused on, well, actually that was part of it. We focused on that for several years, on that direct to consumer B2C market for test prep. And interestingly, then we decided, we wanted to build our own learning management system, a different one. One that was, what we'd built is, if I wanted to change something or add a question or change a full stop to a comma, it would be emailing the programmers over in Indonesia, them doing this nightmare sort of process of just changing simple things. So we wanted to build a sort of a bit of a state-of-the-art learning management system that had a content authoring tool and also the ability for us to basically take control as administrators in Melbourne rather than getting the programmers in Indonesia to do it all. So we, about, I can't remember how many years into the B2C test prep, as that was running and it was ticking over quite well, we shifted attention over to building a B2B product. Let's just call it an LMS. Because we saw that, you know, that initial website that we built, we could improve upon it. And as I said, it was a hell of a lot more efficient to have an authoring tool at our disposal so we could create a mock test and deploy it in a couple of days rather than a couple of months. So then we started doing that. So this thing was sort of running on the side. We hired all the staff and management and, you know, teacher managers and markers to mark essays, because all of a sudden we had thousands of essays, not thousands, we had about I think we had about 100 a day coming in, sort of essays to mark, speaking submissions. So this thing was a bit of a beast into itself. And then we started building this thing on the side, which was very interesting to do. We have since on that, let's just call it a purpose-built LMS, we've since signed up ETS, who have built some TOEFL preparation courses on it. We've signed up Pearson Publishers, the biggest education publisher in the world, who have put some exam prep courses on it to run out to schools, and a few other providers, some universities, English language schools, etc. So chaos, man, chaos, but very interesting process.
Yeah, I'm not sure if you're familiar with the phrase. Maybe you are, but it's not a phrase I use. It's one of these corporate speak. It's corporate speak, but boil the ocean. Do you feel that you were kind of boiling the ocean a bit, as in, you know, you were using proprietary software, you were building it all, you chose not to use third-party plugins. In hindsight, do you think that was a good idea? Obviously, now you say it's a great learning experience, but on balance?
I reckon it was a great idea. It was torturous, and it would have been so much easier just to go, you know what, we're going to use Moodle or Canvas or whatever. However, those platforms cost a lot of money to run, especially when you get large user volume like we had. In fact, on one of those Moodles or Canvases, you can't really run a freemium offering. And that was what did it for us, because, you know, we would need to sign up, whatever it is, 80 to 100 students for every paying customer. So we had this massive free sign-up rate. And then the objective for us was to convert them to paying customers through building bloody good product and also marketing really well, social media, calls to actions, all the whole thing. So it was all about became a conversion game for us. Had we have used an off-the-shelf LMS, we wouldn't have been able to play that game. We would have needed to have the students there already. I understand that for schools and for universities, you know, they've got a pipeline of students coming in that they get through marketing and through education agents, etc. So they don't really need to fill, we used to call it the swimming pool, fill the swimming pool with free users from which you would convert, you know, a handful, which then became your daily revenue, etc. And then the other thing, I guess, was also, you know, well, two things. One, you own the software, you own the IP. If you're using someone else's LMS, you don't own that. And let's say you build a really good business. Well, you can't sell that to a company. You can never do an acquisition because they wouldn't buy. Well, they can't buy it. It's not your software. So we own the source code for this software. So, you know, one day should we want to sell this company, we can. And the other thing which was critical was because the software was proprietary, we were building it ourselves, we could think of cool things to do with it. We wanted to build a study scheduler. So students knew on what days, you know, they needed to do which practice questions. And we wanted to, as I mentioned before, with the scheduling tool, we needed it to perform all these functions that plugins wouldn't perform. And critically, even just with the user interfaces, we needed it to look and smell and feel like a PT academic test and not like something else. Yeah, so in the end, I think it was a very brave, courageous, crazy decision from my co-founder, actually. I kicked and screamed, but went for the ride, but I think it was worth it.
And a lot of people who work in this space as exam prep, it's quite competitive, to say the least. What you say is maybe students are harder to convert to paying customers. There's a lot of free stuff out there, YouTube videos, cheaper providers, for example. And also, you know, your students are not going to be with you long term, are they? Hopefully they will pass the exam as quickly as possible and, you know, bye-bye, they won't see you again. So how did you meet those challenges?
Yeah, good question. You're right. You don't get recurring revenue from a test prep student unless they fail. So subscription models didn't really make sense for us. It was packages. You know, they would buy a package, and the package would come with, you know, X number of tutorials, X number of writing feedback, or number of live classes. So we had to really think about the business model and think, okay, what are we offering here? How can we divide this up? How can we separate the gold package from the silver package, you know, all that sort of stuff. So we did end up, you know, building a pretty good business model around test prep. So the packages were appealing. Then with conversion, you're right, you know, we were our own worst enemy in some ways with giving content away to attract them, but then not giving away enough so that they would convert. Meanwhile, you're playing so we're competing with ourselves there about, oh, how much can we give away? Let's just imagine for a second that there were no competitors anywhere in the market. You would give very little away. You know, you would give one or two videos or whatever it is. And, you know, so the package then becomes incredibly appealing. But that's not the case, because you have these competitors on YouTube and, you know, giving free practice questions, free mock tests, every day of the week. So we needed to outperform our competitors whilst not giving away the farm. So our strategy for that was to outperform the competitors. We needed to provide better quality videos. Let's just focus on YouTube, because that was our biggest source of new customers, free or paid. So on YouTube, which became our most important social media stream, we really just thought, okay, let's just outperform the competitors in terms of quality. We'll just teach better than them. We'll just think through the true, false, not given question in IELTS, or the TOEFL independent essay, or the PT academic describe image, and really do our homework. And this sort of became my job, because I was reasonably good at reading the literature, applied linguistics literature, you know, the complex stuff, thinking through how to make that simplified so I could then, you know, make a video and provide that to students. And it worked. I think that's why, you know, our YouTube channels now sit at about 2.5 million subscribers all up, is because of quality. You get YouTube teachers who would sort of, they're full of crap. They would teach some, people can see through it. Some people can't. A bit of charlatan stuff. Some people fall for it, but other people knew that, especially if they'd gone and taken the IELTS and failed, they're like, okay, this is a legitimately challenging test. There's no way to game this. There's no tips, tricks, and hacks. It is methodologies, sentence structures, cohesion, you know, quite complex applied linguistic stuff. But of course, that needed to be simplified down, because you're teaching an engineer. An engineer doesn't care about, you know, a compound, complex sentence or subordinate clauses, whatever. You've got to find a way to deliver that information to the engineer so she can go and take her IELTS test and write a good sentence and a good essay and get the grade she deserves. So YouTube became a fascinating game for us, and one that we competed, we thought a lot about and competed very strongly. In the end, we ended up having our own little media wing of the company, with, you know, three full-time videographers, an audio guy. My job in the end there was just to write YouTube's research and write YouTube scripts and present. Because it was such a mainstay of our B2C business.
So for people listening in, they want to build a YouTube channel, you need to have really great content with sound academic underpinnings and also great production values.
Yep, and you've also got to make it, in a sense, gimmicky, right? Because it can't be too academic, because it'll turn people away. So it has to have good production value. But you have to, you know, there's a real art form there where you're taking something extremely complex. Let me just think for a second what it might be. Let's say it's connected speech, because in PT academic, you know, you have to use connected speech, which is linguistically complex, you know, elision, deletion, all of these strange concepts. But you have to deliver that in a way where you never use that sort of meta language and it just makes sense. So you might do it sort of, deductive teaching where you give them the example first, then show them how to do it rather than talk to them about the theory of it and then get them to do it. So we developed all these really cool teaching techniques as well. I think it really helped me as a teacher about how to structure information, simplify stuff. It was a cool experience. But you're right. I think if you want to win the YouTube thing, it's a matter of good quality content.
And also you mentioned a lot of people who, try to compete in the marketplace. It's about, creating more noise, as you say, a little bit more gimmicky. They try to maybe niche or, they look at targeted ads. But at the end of the day, if the content itself, if the value proposition is not good, people won't buy and they won't refer their friends and they won't you won't retain them as a customer.
That's right. One of our competitors had an unbelievably popular video because he got this, it was for an IELTS speaking test, and the girl he chose to do the speaking test was beautiful, like stunningly gorgeous girl, and it got, I think it's had 6 million views or something in a year or whatever it was. But if you read the comments below the video, people aren't there to learn about IELTS. They're there because it's incredible clickbait. It was very interesting and smart strategy from him to do that. But whether or not that actually converted to paying customers is, I'm not sure. Perhaps it would have had a small effect. Maybe they subscribed hoping that she would come back, but at the end of the day, it's about trust. It's about trust and it's about being a bloody good teacher. And the teacher, him or herself, can come in all sorts of shapes and sizes. That doesn't matter, but they want to believe the words that come from your mouth. And I think we were able to achieve that.
It also struck me when you were talking about, development of your software, your website and your partner was from the outset. I don't know if this was you or your partner or maybe the company culture, but there seemed to be a lot of commitment and belief in what you were doing.
Yeah, I think it's the main co-founder that we worked together on this for such a long time. We were both teachers. He was a university professor, so he taught a sort of higher level. He taught law at university. But him and I were deeply committed to the teaching and learning process, and we knew, that's really what drove it. We weren't MBAs coming in thinking, oh, we're just going to get user numbers and, strip these people as much money as possible. We were deeply committed to the product, actually, and to our detriment, I think. It wasn't until we got a few sort of shrewd finance savvy people in that we were able to sort of pay more attention to revenues and conversion rates and, the bottom line, really. So we were too busy in product and tech, content and tech, to really notice that. We did pretty well, considering neither of us had a background in business or finance or anything like that. But when we brought in some MBAs, they were then able to sort of enhance the product and the business, if you like. I think we would have done all right, but maybe not. Maybe we would have hit a roadblock just because we would. It's really hard to beat the teacher out of a teacher. It's really hard to make a teacher a business person. I ended up being okay at it. It's definitely not my predilection. I'm a classroom teacher by nature. I tried to convert a few teachers into sort of a more business mindset, and it was bloody difficult because they're too focused on quality of product, etc., and not focused on, okay, we actually need to get revenue in and whatnot.
That's very interesting because I've had a few focus groups with teachers, and You know, I try to steer the conversation in the direction of where is the money? You know, show me the money. That's kind of my catchphrase. But yeah, you're right. I think for a lot of teachers, they care about the students, don't they? So for somebody who is a teacher starting a business, you know, actually empathizing with the students, good customer service, that's all going to be there naturally, isn't it? But it's shifting the mindset from the classroom and, you know, non-direct, let's say, revenue making to, you know, you're at a remove, aren't you? You get your students there, but, you know, they pay in the admin office, don't they? They don't pay you directly. So you don't really see the value. And sometimes people don't even know what students pay. And sometimes when teachers find out what schools charge students, they're like, you know, they say, oh, my God, I'm going to start my own school. That's kind of the trigger for a lot of people. So, yeah, what do you think holds teachers back? Is it just the culture? Is just the, you know, the teacher themselves? Why do you think this?
I mean, it's just a mindset. I personally think I was just born to be a teacher. I just always thought I was going to do it, and I did it, and I'm bloody good at it, and I love it. You know, and then you'll meet somebody who was just born to be an accountant. And I was certainly not born to be an engineer. You know, I've got engineering friends and they'll love to I'll go around to the house and they'll be tinkering on car motors and stuff. And I'll sit in the corner and read a book on linguistics because I'm just like, oh, I don't care how an internal combustion engine works, you know. So, but in saying that, if you're a teacher and you've got an entrepreneurial streak or you just want to get out of the classroom or, you know, have the autonomy to work for yourself or something like that, you know, you have to at some point sacrifice the care and attention that you'll give to an individual student, for example, it'll take up too much of your time. It becomes about time. You need to think, okay, and I struggled with this, you know, getting out of the, you know, they had to basically drag me out of the giving tutorials and the webinars and stuff because I could get somebody else in to do that. You know, once I had sort of created the content, created the system, you know, that sort of thing, I could get somebody in to then do that job. Then I could move on to another job and sort of create those structures and get somebody in to do that. And then I could move on to the next thing. So I was very good at creating those systems and the content and whatever, but I wasn't good at delegating and handing it across because I felt too much care for the product, for the students, etc. And I think there's also, you know, if you are a teacher out there thinking of going it alone, maybe consider getting a business partner who is not a teacher. Consider getting a business partner who has a background in business rather than, you know, education. There's going to be tension because they'll be pushing towards, you know, growth, scale, revenue, cutting costs. These sorts of things hurt teachers who are sort of socialists by nature. But that tension's good. That's the tension that you need to push forward. We had a really interesting stage there where we moved from, as I mentioned, you know, Don and I built the sort of startup, very much product focused. But when we shifted to scale up and we needed to get in the spreadsheets and the, you know, look at the revenue and cut costs and, God forbid, cut some teachers' wages because we were paying them way too much, you know, stuff like that was really necessary. But it was tension fueled in the office because, you know, it had two very different mindsets, but absolutely necessary for it to push forward and to grow. Depends if you want to grow though, because there's also this crazy idea that everything should scale and maybe things shouldn't scale. Maybe you should just build a little boutique business and keep it at three people and you'd live a happier life. Scale is a pretty crazy experience. You know, it's not particularly, it's kind of thrilling, but you always, as a teacher, you always try not to sacrifice any integrity, product integrity, content integrity, etc., pedagogical integrity, but you have to.
Yeah, a shout out to Ian Simpson, who I've interviewed here in the past on the podcast, and Ian. I think he's what, three schools maybe now? Ian, you'll correct me, I'm sure. But he just now he has three schools, he can go surfing. That's You know, he doesn't need to scale anymore. He says, that's, you know, I'm a satiated state. Isn't that what Bismarck said? But yeah, you brought the point about having a good partner and people who can kind of complement, supplement, maybe work against you as a counterbalance to maybe some excesses or, you know, mind blocks that people have. It kind of reminds me of a, what was it say? If you have an accountant as a CEO, you'll have a business, but no sales. If you have a salesperson as a CEO, you'll have sales, but no business. But yeah. I wonder, yeah, so a lot of people, you know, they come from, like, say, engineering background. And, of course, nowadays with, you know, since the 60s, 70s, Intel and, you know, the newer companies, Microsoft, Apple, et cetera, come from that area. But traditionally, you know, there would have been a lot of accountants. People come from an education background. So your partner, you came from obviously education background. Your business partner?
Yeah, so one of them came from law, legal professor. But he had a, you know, we were complementary to each other because he was a systems thinker. I'm a very linear thinker. He could think in systems. So I was really good at content development and sort of, you know, the pedagogical stuff. I mean, my background was in linguistics, his was law. He was really good at the tech stuff, designing tech, because tech's very nonlinear. You know, it's building you know, systems that interlink and stuff like this. So we had sort of complementary skill sets there. Then one of the other early employees who became the CEO, still the CEO, was a banker in his past life. And so, you know, he was great at bringing in we raised a bit of capital. He was great at just watching the revenue going in and out and making sure we were staying alive, because it's the bloodstream. And you know, our focus wasn't there. So yeah, so you know, you want to pick people who are dissimilar to you. I think, you know, if I were to do a startup again, I would pick people who perhaps I wouldn't even like them, but I'd want to like them, but certainly have dissimilar skill sets, because you don't want to choose somebody who thinks similarly to you. That's not going to help.
Absolutely. It's kind of like a bunker mentality. It's like all the generals around Hitler or something. Yeah. But maybe that's an extreme example. But yeah, I've seen some vocab learning software designed by engineers. That's pretty wacky stuff, isn't it?
Dude, I'm fascinated by you know, phone applications for language learning, websites for language learning, and I look at their sort of, you know, pedagogical integrity, efficacy, and yeah, there's a lot of improvement. Let's say, you know, some of those big ones. I muck around on some of those big commercial applications, Duolingo, Mondly at the moment. I reckon I can do a Mondly lesson and I don't reckon I learn anything, to be frank with you. They seem to be good for, and Duolingo seems to be pretty good for revision of already acquired languages. It's good for vocab revision for me personally. But you know, Duolingo's genius, right? Because they do have, what is it, half a billion users, many of whom come back. You know, their retention rates are actually bloody good because they put a lot of effort into those extrinsic motivators. You know, they have algorithms telling when you will receive the push notification to come back to study. You know, they've thought through this stuff at such a granular level, it's extraordinary. So, and to be frank with you, if they change their pedagogy to something not as fun but more effective, they wouldn't have a business, right? Their business is not really around language learning. Their business is really around returning users and obviously generating, converting those returning users into paid users. So they've got to strike this unbelievable balance with some of those language activities are stupid. I don't think they do anything, but they're bloody fun, and the little things, bells and whistles and points and stuff like that. So arguably they're more effective than anything else, because at least something's going on. At least it's just not an app, a dormant app that nobody uses. So it's a strange game they play there, but it seems something's working for sure.
Yeah, they seem to have taken a leaf out of the book of Las Vegas casino designers, don't they? With bells, whistles, dopamine hits and jingles and clang of change. Yeah.
I was walking through a casino the other day. I don't go to casinos and don't gamble, but I was walking through a casino and I saw some slot machines, pokies we call them in Australia. Holy moly, man. These things now, you sit in like this capsule, like it's an iPad, it's like a 6 foot high iPad screen. And I can't imagine when you're addicted to those, what's going on neurologically, like the colors, the you know, the sensory experience going on there. But of course I thought, holy moly, imagine if you could turn that, you know, this little module capsule thing you sit in into a language learning experience. That would be freaking cool. The other thing I did the other day was I went to an arcade and used virtual reality for the first time. Went on a roller coaster, a virtual roller coaster. And as much as it actually made me sick, nauseous, which I think it does to a lot of people, it's just like, wow, okay, the future, not, I don't think anytime soon, because people, you know, smartphones are the smartphones is where it's at now and will be for the next 10 years at least. People, you know, the subcontinental Indians won't be owning virtual reality headsets in the next 20 years, right? So I think smartphones is where the technology is at now, and I still think apps are, you know, a native app built for language learning is the way to go in the near term. But once virtual reality is sorted out, especially the nausea, and I know there is a company in the States called Immerse working on this at the moment for language learning, but that's going to be extraordinary.
So I just thought of a name for a company. You could Linguomancer, a little bit like the William Gibson. You could be fully immersed into language learning. I'm not sure if that's something that will happen in the future. But it kind of reminds me. You talked about pokies. I'm not sure if you've ever been here to Japan, but I don't know if they have the same in Korea. But you're familiar, of course, with pachinko parlors and the noise. Basically, it's you get a ball, a bucket of ball bearings, and you play a game with them, kind of a slot machine game. I actually don't know how it works. I've never done it because just the noise is unbearable. It's like basically ball bearings in a washing machine. So when you go by, it's just, it's above anything. But you're right. Yeah, for us, it might put us off. But for somebody addicted to pachinko, it's a siren call, isn't it, to the machine?
Amazing. You know, Duolingo's little leaderboards and just the sort of status they create for this imaginary status they create for the user. And, you know, there are memes going around of that owl that people feel dejected, or the owl is evil because you haven't studied on the app for 24 hours. But yeah, as I said, they're getting returning users. That is, especially in the world of phone apps, that's returning users is where it's at. That's the metric.
The owl does lay the guilt trip, doesn't it? And trying to avoid the emails. You know, you haven't studied for a few days. What's happening now? So, they definitely use the psychology against you. So for somebody starting out in ELT, you know, maybe a teacher, a business owner, where are the opportunities for entrepreneurs?
Well, if you think about it, I would go niche, and I would try to nail a niche. If you're going to start teaching IELTS, well, you're immediately in an ocean of, you know, God knows how many IELTS teachers in your local city. Then again, if you're in a place where there's no IELTS teachers, there you go. That's a good place to start. I would focus on sort of, you know, like we did, we focused on OET first, a niche test with very few competitors, very, very difficult subject matter. So bloody hard to write an OET mock test, for example, extremely valuable. But if you can teach yourself that skill, then that's a good thing to do. I don't know, because I'm so test prep centric. You know, we looked at other stuff. We looked at aviation English. We looked at English for taxi drivers. We looked at some business English stuff, but B2B is very difficult, you know, selling to businesses. B2C is a challenge, because you have to have that swimming pool, you know. if I could give away a solution, I would, but I don't know. You know, in many ways, we were lucky that we found a market, to be honest, because it could have just as easily, the story of E2, the counterfactual story could have been that CEO of OET never invited us to build the thing and the business was dead and we terminated it and that was it and I'm teaching English in the classroom. But there you go.
I think I'll title this podcast Sliding Doors, maybe. That would be, yeah. So for you, Jared, you've now... I don't like to use the word departed. It sounds a bit final, doesn't it? But
No.
You're now, I see you're still on the website. You still do some teaching for E2?
No, I've just a bit of the legacy videos now. So my face will be around. In a sense, I felt like it was mission complete for me. I'd helped to build out the B2C. It was ticking over. The content's done. There's enough videos on YouTube to last the next 15 years. We got some really smart product people to come in, so I sort of stepped back. Well, not even stepped back. I departed. I'm finished there. I had an opportunity to. I got offered a PhD scholarship at the University of Melbourne, and it really for me that felt like the next step for me. I've had this sort of interest in test prep and more than an interest, obviously, but I wanted to take that to the next level. So my PhD will be in language assessment. I'm still very interested in mobile technology in general for language learning. So my PhD research will be developing a language test that will be smartphone delivered. And I'm particularly interested in building language tests for specific purposes. What I'm planning to do is to go into the aged care industry to build a diagnostic English language test for aged care workers. Following that, I might try and build one for engineers because I'm very much interested in language assessment being fairer. I think it's very unfair that you might be an engineer and you have to write an essay on something totally unrelated to engineering. These language assessments are pretty blunt instruments as far as I'm concerned right now. Look, they're amazing. They're amazing, but I still think they're blunt in the grand scheme of things. I'm a big fan of the OET because if you're a doctor, you'll be reading case notes, you know, written for doctors. If you're a physiotherapist, you do the same for physiotherapy. So what my research will entail will be to actually go into these environments, aged care homes, and look at the language that's used. It's called a domain analysis. So I'll be going in and actually looking at all the verbs and nouns and adjectives used in an aged care home, which will be fascinating. You know, there'll be I'll tell you an interesting story. I just got married, and my wife is originally from. Well, she was born in Afghanistan. She came here when she was 6 years old. So she's been here for a long time, but. And her family own and run a commercial bakery they bake Afghan cakes and cookies. And just because I'm sort of between jobs and hanging out at the moment, I'm working one day a week in this Afghan bakery. And I'm also learning Dari, the Persian language. And so I've been conducting my own sort of domain analysis, going in and looking at the weird world of language in a specific environment. In a bakery where there are interesting machines and tools and phrases used to use these tools and machines and, you know, spatulas and packaging machines and things overflowing. So I'm very conscious of all the language that's being used there. So I'm really interested in building language tests for professional purposes because, one, I think it's fairer. And two, I think it's going to be extraordinarily valuable for somebody to, they call it the backwash effect, you know, to improve their English language skills by preparing for these tests. It will actually make them better at their job. So, you know, it's kind of interesting. It's a curious sort of way to do it. I'm kind of doing it backwards by working in this bakery. But, it's fascinating stuff.
Right. So a lot of plans for the future, Jared. And to our listeners, I'll in the show notes, I put a link to E2 and your profile as well on LinkedIn for anybody who wants to work with you or, you know, inquire about some of the fascinating work you're doing. And Jared, thanks again.
No worries, Phil. I appreciate the conversation. It was good fun. Hopefully there was some value there for people doing interesting things, because I still, language learning, we certainly haven't solved the problem. So there's still a lot to be done. And I wish everyone well.
Thanks for listening to the EFL Magazine Business Podcast with Philip Pound. For more great advice and resources, check out EFLmagazine.com. If you found this podcast helpful, be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. See you next time.